The manhunt intensifies this morning for the gunmen who caused carnage on the streets of Paris. Good morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9, and thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross. We are always live at 9, and now never miss a show. Subscribe to the Daily Podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. Just ahead, we'll take your calls as airstrikes begin in retaliation for the deadly attacks in Paris. You can get on the line now with your thoughts at 549-2937. Also this morning, raising awareness about type 1 diabetes here on the First Coast. Then later, Cole Pepper on the Jaguars' thrilling win over the weekend. Plus, the founders of Firehouse Subs tell us about their big donation they've got planned for this Thursday night during the halftime show at home at Everbank Field. All of that ahead on the show this morning. But first this hour, police in France and Belgium say they've launched dozens of anti-terrorism raids this morning as authorities search for the suspects in Friday's deadly attacks in Paris. The intense manhunt for the possible lead plotter in the attacks comes as clearer portraits emerge of the network behind the carnage that left more than 130 people dead and dozens more injured. France responded to the attack it blames on the Islamic State Sunday with airstrikes on the group's Syrian stronghold in the city of Raqqa. On Wednesday, President François Hollande will present a bill to the National Assembly calling for a three-month state of emergency. That's a move granting exceptional police powers to restrict freedom of movement and gatherings in public. Now, the U.S. has been part of a coalition of countries taking part in airstrikes against the Islamic State in Syria and Iraq, but some of the Republican presidential candidates are calling loudly for the deployment of U.S. ground forces. Saturday night, the Democratic presidential hopefuls clashed over the best way to deal with the militant group. We begin the hour this morning with two local analysts giving their thoughts. Dr. Parvez Ahmed, director of the Center for Sustainable Business Practices, professor of finance with the Coggin College of Business at the University of North Florida. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa.
And Dr. Christopher Roederer, professor of law and director of international programs with Florida Coastal School of Law.
Good morning.
And your calls are already coming in. Let us know your thoughts and questions about the attacks in Paris and the response, 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online to wjctnews.org/firstcoastconnect. Email and tweet the show. Parvez Ahmed, after the attack in Paris, it looks as though U.S. strategy in terms of ISIS is taking a turn. Your thoughts?
Well, first, our condolences to the people of Paris and the people that lost their loved ones, and an unequivocal condemnation to the people who perpetrated these heinous acts. You know, if we react, or if Paris and France reacts to this attack as we reacted after 9/11, fueled by vengeance, then the results would be predictably familiar. We are dealing with a type of a group, a nihilistic group that does not have any core ideology or even a core grievance. They are trying to draw us into a battle, a existential battle, in a manner that we will give up our cherished values. We will compromise on many things, and we will play into the hands of our enemies. That's my fear. It seems like people at ISIS, Daesh, or ISIL, whatever way you want to call them, want to provoke a clash of civilization. And it seems like some of our leaders are obliging them in that clash of civilization.
Dr. Roederer, do you agree?
Yes, I largely do agree. Unfortunately, our reactions post 9/11 did not necessarily help us fight a war on terror. I think if you fight a war on terror, you have the tendency of creating more terror. And I think our policies, even since in Syria, in Iraq, in Afghanistan, the use of predator drones, the so-called collateral damage, which is a very sad way of talking about the death of innocent human lives, has a cost. And the situation in France is horrific and very sad, but not completely unpredictable. We shouldn't expect to engage in a war like this or a series of wars or conflicts like this and be immune from the consequences, either here or in Europe, for that engagement. And so I think it's a stark reminder that engagement in a conflict like this does threaten to come home. And it's not just something that happens overseas.
The Islamic State just this morning is warning in a new video that countries taking part in airstrikes against Syria would suffer the same fate as France. A new video just posted by the Islamic State is now threatening to attack in Washington, D.C. So let me ask you, Dr. Ahmed, those that are warning Western governments not to take the bait, so to speak, not to fall into the trap you believe ISIS is setting, what then is the appropriate response?
Well, first of all, you take these threats seriously. ISIS does have the capacity, and they have shown this not just in Paris, they shown this in Beirut, they showed this in Turkey, possibly by downing the Russian airplane in Egypt. So they do have the capability to commit terror and mayhem. So you take this threat seriously, and you hope that our security professionals will be able to protect us in these situations. If you look at the story, even this story in Paris, there is a story now that the Turkish officials had warned French security forces about one of the perpetrators in this Paris attack, almost like a year, maybe 10 months ago. And somehow that warning did not lead to an arrest of this individual or a detention of this individual. We learned about the similar story with the Boston attackers, that they were warned about, our security personnel, FBI, was warned about the Boston attackers months before they actually carried out their attack. So we do have a serious reexamination of maybe it's a matter of resources, the security people are understaffed or under-resourced, but we have also spent hundreds and millions, billions of dollars since 9/11 on security. And so between our launching of attacks after 9/11 and all of the security maneuvers that we have done and the severe incursions in civil liberties that we have incurred, a serious abridgment of our freedom, it does not appear that we are 100% safe. So part of the equation has to be that maybe in a free society like this, we can never be 100% safe. And so we have to, in some sense, manage the risk as opposed to create this this perception that we can create 100% security if we create a no-fly zone in Syria, or if we send troops in Syria, or if we start monitoring everybody's phone calls, somehow we will be 100% safe. We can't. And so we have to deal with the risk the way the risk is presented to us and not overreach. My big fear right now is that France will overreach and we will overreach along with France. And we will revisit what happened after 9/11. So 14 years after 9/11, we sent troops to Afghanistan. Afghanistan is not a safe country, and we are no safer because we sent troops to Afghanistan.
You've also pointed out that the vast majority of victims of ISIS are Muslim, in fact. But before the Paris attack, several dozen people were killed in Beirut, Lebanon, mm-hmm. by the Islamic State. That didn't get nearly the amount of publicity. Let me ask you both as a follow-up. Sharp partisan divide in this country between the Republican and Democratic presidential candidates when it comes to the response to the carnage in Paris. On the debate stage, the Republican candidates are demanding that President Obama and that anyone running for president come right out and say that we are at war with radical Islam. The Democrats, for the most part, Hillary Clinton in particular, do not want to use that rhetoric. What are your thoughts about that divide?
Well, I'm not sure what it means, actually, to have a war against radical Islam. I don't find it particularly helpful. And I don't consider the Republican response particularly helpful. It may be easy to say we're going to go in, we're going to bomb, we're going to send troops. But I think that's easy rhetoric that fits into sort of a revenge or a feeling of revenge, of an eye for an eye, of somehow this is going to make us safer. But there's no indication that attacks or bombing or invading or troops on the ground will in any way diminish attacks against us.
Well, a couple of facts. I think what happens in a situation like this, everybody gets so emotional, and the media kind of whips us into a frenzy, and the politicians, then the rhetoric begins to run, and we begin to lose sight of some of the facts. One of the facts you mentioned, Melissa, was that the primary victims of ISIS are Muslims. In fact, 9 out of 10 victims of ISIS are Muslims. It's not primary, it's overwhelming majority of victims are Muslims. Number two, the people in the region, the powers in the region, will have to step up and do much more because they are the primary targets. It's the near war that ISIS is mostly focused on, not the distant war.
Do you fault the Gulf states?
Definitely.
Saudi Arabia in particular?
Definitely. Not just Saudi Arabia, Turkey, Saudi Arabia, the Gulf states have definitely enabled the rise of ISIS. And they are, and they have either directly enabled it or they have remained quiet as this force kind of metastasized. But it's not just the Gulf states. It's also Iraq itself. Because Iraq created a sectarian government after we deposed Saddam Hussein. And that sectarian government, along with our actions of disbanding the existing Iraqi government infrastructure, both the security infrastructure as well as government officials who were primarily Sunni. So you have a sectarian government. Then with our help, we deposed all of the people that were part of the Iraqi government apparatus. These people have no jobs and with guns on their hand. What do you expect them to become? So it has been a cascading of policy failures, along with the inaction of the people and the governments, particularly the governments in the region, that have created this problem. And so going after another military adventure in the Middle East, I do not see how that helps to stem this scourge.
Let's go to your calls right now, 549-2937. Ed in Orange Park. Go ahead, Ed.
Yes, I'd like to disagree with your guess about their conclusion that somehow the act of barbarity has connected with any activity that the West, some of the Western countries are doing over there. These people, as you all know quite well, have been killing and murdering, including in their own nation, from Yazidis to Christian communities to anybody who they disagree with, including other Muslim groups, as it was mentioned there, for because one simple reason, because they exist. If a Mexican who is not at war with Mexico with any of these people, no activity of military acts against them, or from Bolivia or from Botswana, would be also murdered if they were to be found there just simply because they don't belong to the particular version of Islam that they profess. So this is a clash of civilization. Now, the thing that's hard to understand, because you have to put yourself in other people's shoes, if we had a bunch of crazy, fanatical Christians who come up with some kind of Christian caliphate in the middle of a Christian enclave like South America, do you think that the first one who would be so upset and disgusted by it would be the fellow Christian? We will be the one, hopefully, who will be volunteering to go there and fight the savages. I don't understand why. What is the Muslim community, who, as Dr. Pavlin had mentioned, is the main victims of this group, are not jumping there and volunteering to the other side and fight these animals? Thank you.
Well, they are. I mean, there are people who are fighting ISIS are also Muslims. The Kurds who are fighting ISIS, who have taken the fight to ISIS and they have cut off one of their main cities now, are also Muslims. So to think that Muslims are not in the forefront of bearing the burden as from both sides, from trying to fight the ISIS fighters, but also bearing the brunt of the backlash from ISIS is kind of ridiculous. It's one of the things that kind of gets lost in this conversation. Is this idea that we are in a clash of civilization with ISIS. First of all, ISIS is not a civilization. When we put ISIS would like to claim they're a civilization, and they would like to draw us into a clash of civilization. But ISIS is neither Islamic nor a state nor a civilization. They are a criminal enterprise, and they should be dealt with as such. So there has to be much more coordination with the nations in the region. to have a security response to it, but putting American boots on the ground or instituting a no-fly zone and some of the other ideas that have been in circulation for a very long period of time, I don't see how it helps. At the end of the day, we have to stop the recruitment of ISIS. And ISIS.
And how do we do that?
And there are several ways in which we can attempt to do it. First of all, look at our security budget versus our development budget. ISIS is being able to recruit people who are disaffected, who are grieved because of a lack of political resolutions in those societies and a lack of economic opportunities. We spend probably 1% of our security budget on development. We have spent over $5 trillion in securities and wars since 9/11. We have spent a tiny, tiny fraction of that in development. Maybe it is time to re-examine our policies. Also, that our continuing support, even now, to fight ISIS, we will have to rely on the very dictators that are creating the conditions on the ground that ISIS is recruiting from.
And at the same time, Dr. Roederer, you will be speaking tonight about the role of government and free speech, a separate topic, which we had initially booked you to discuss. You'll be speaking tonight at the Buckman Bridge Unitarian Universalist Church. But there will be some strange bedfellows emerging out of the tragedy in Paris as Vladimir Putin and Barack Obama meet, as we speak, in fact, to discuss how to recalibrate the geopolitical strategy the U.S. and Russia are trying to forge when it comes to ISIS, Syria's role, how Russia will deploy forces. This is recalibrating U.S. strategy.
Well, and Russia has seriously complicated the issue in Syria. I mean, it was already fraught with complications. Part of the reason Obama was very hesitant to go in to begin with was because the opposition to the leadership there was not a black and white, clear-cut problem. And Russia, of course, has severely complicated that with its targeting of any opposition. And by any opposition, largely not ISIS opposition. And unless you can get Russia on our side, or at least come to some agreement about the arrangements between us and them, it's going to be very difficult to come to any solution.
Jim tweets the show, unlike Al-Qaeda, ISIS wants to take civilization back to year zero. Al-Qaeda wanted our bases gone. ISIS wants to start the world anew. Adam in Jacksonville is on the line. Go ahead, Adam.
Yes, this is Adam. I'm just from Jacksonville. I'm originally actually a Kurd from that region. I really disagree with your speakers as far as the threats of ISIS against the countries that are leading these strikes against ISIS. That threat actually is only a short term. ISIS, when it dominates its feet on the ground, is going to try to bring back the rules of the Quran and the Sharia, which basically going to force us to all either become Muslim or to follow their rules. So these threats that are threatening these countries against their strikes, actually, this is like an aspirin, you know. We have to be involved sooner, as soon as possible, because if we do not get involved there, they're going to come here, and then they're going to force us really to dominate the Sharia law in the country, you know.
And Adam, tell me how you came to this. Tell us how you came to this area. Tell us a little bit more about your background.
Well, we came, my parents, actually, my father was working through the American organizations back in the Gulf War. My father was working with them, and that's how we came here. It's been almost 20 years. And since I remember, actually, we've lived through the ISIS laws and then the threat of ISIS. Just recently, if you listen to the Kurdish channel, they've discovered actually 15 massive graves in the city of Shingal. Why? Because those people were Yazidi. They do not practice Islam. And then what happened, they took over the city, just like old days, you know, they took all the men, they buried them alive. use the woman for sex, and then for whatever reason they want, and then they bury them alive afterwards if they refuse to become Muslim. ISIS is a real threat to everyone in this world. We have to get involved as soon as possible. Otherwise, it's going to come here and it's going to force us to involve here in this country.
Okay.
I'm proud of America that actually I am American today. And it's a real issue. I mean, we have to be involved there, actually, not here, you know.
Thank you, Adam.
Before it gets here.
Thank you, Adam. That's Adam on the line. Dr. Ahmed.
Yeah, I think the caller is, Adam is expressing a sentiment that is probably reflective of the sentiment of many Americans, and I completely understand where he's coming from. However, when we say we want to get involved there, we never define what does our involvement mean. Does our involvement mean, of course we have to be involved in these geopolitical conflicts. We have to figure out ways to resolve these conflicts. But what is unsaid and undefined in our yearning for to be involved is what does that involvement mean? Does that involvement mean we send 150,000 troops back to Iraq and Syria? We tried that experiment. We tried that for 10 years. It didn't work well. We are still in Afghanistan after 14 years of invading that country. And that experiment is not going well. So when we say we want to get involved, I would love to hear from people who want us to get more involved. And I would like us to get more involved too. But I think the involvement has to be of a different nature. It has to be both security as well as, it has to be military as well as development. It has to be military as well as trying to resolve some of the underlying political grievances. And these problems did not erupt in one day. ISIS is Al-Qaeda in Iraq. ISIS is essentially an extension, a reformation of Al-Qaeda in Iraq. And Al-Qaeda in Iraq formed after we invaded Iraq. There was no Al-Qaeda in Iraq before we invaded Iraq. So we have to go back and re-examine our own actions. And in our desire to do good, we hope we do not end up doing more harm and particularly unintended consequences.
Matt writes on our Facebook page, is this what containment looks like? Taking a hit against President Obama's comment right before the attacks that the administration had contained the Islamic State. Well, Dr. Roederer.
Well, I don't think you can ever contain an idea. And so, sure, you may be able to contain a certain number of people on the ground in a certain place. But I think part of the problem with our containment strategy or any of our strategies is that we have a long history of getting involved throughout the world. And we have a long history of not getting involved for all the right reasons and for not supporting all the right people. And so, you know, when we do get involved, I think people question our motives. They don't necessarily see it as us getting involved simply to promote democracy and freedom. And so I think that complicates things. We've, you know, our current involvement and some of our allies' involvement has not supported clearly the good guys, so to speak. And so, you know, that maybe more support for moderate Muslims in the Middle East would have helped, and maybe earlier involvement to support some of the Arab Spring in the right ways would have helped. But I think it's impossible to completely contain anything that's a moving entity that's trying to recruit and trying to grow and trying to feed off of easy storylines.
Jolie in St. Augustine. Jolie, good morning. Thanks for holding. You're on the air.
Good morning. Good morning. I like the analogy to these people being like thugs. And I'd like to make a further analogy of the different places where thugs have taken over where there's a void, like Mexico or the drug lords in South America or Russia's big criminal element. And I feel like if there's a void, that it's more of a psychological war that has to be fought because they are filling a need because people are joining them or in fear of them or have a need to listen to these people and do as they say. And we can't combat it with bombs because whatever that is much more powerful than just like people are getting threatened on both sides. And the people who are going to kill you right in your face are much more important than the threat of death down the way. So we have to understand what's going on in these countries. And I'm not even sure if we are capable of understanding what's going on in these companies, because we don't have the same outlook. So I believe that this is something that we have to support the people in Iraq, the people in Syria, the people who understand their own cultures to be able to combat what's going on. We have to empower people. And thank you very much.
Dr. Ahmed.
So, Melissa, I think the caller is absolutely right. We have to empower the people there. And we have some resources over here that unfortunately has not been tapped into to the extent that those resources are available. We have a very educated and very empowered American Muslim community. Many of these people have deep roots, whether in Syria or in Iraq or in Afghanistan or in many other parts of the world. We have not been able to adequately tap into that network and use them, both the knowledge that these people have of the region and the deep love that they profess for this country, and to combine those into a strategy and an action that will allow us to convey to the people in the region that we are not their enemies.
Speaking of Syria, what do you both think of growing calls, particularly by some of the presidential candidates, to not accept any more Syrian refugees? And those calls are also growing in Europe.
I think that's the wrong answer. The people who are refugees are fleeing from this sort of oppression. They want to come to Europe. They want to come to America because of the freedom. They don't hate our freedoms. They want the freedom, the opportunity, the things that we promise in these countries. And sure, there it's possible that some bad apples could come through that process, but they can easily come through a number of other processes too. They can come as entrepreneurs on entrepreneur visas or as on student visas. And I think it'd be very sad for us to close off our doors, or for Europe to close off its doors, to the people who are yearning for freedom and trying to escape this horrendous situation in Syria.
Well, this will again, if we close off our borders and we turn our backs on the refugees, it will actually help ISIS recruit more, because they would love to recruit from the people who are fleeing. They would love to tell them that, look, the West is not your friend. And so we have to be very careful. I think the emotional response favors that idea that we have to stop, close the borders and not allow refugees in. But I think the rational response is that we can allow refugees in, and we do have the ability to process them. Nobody is asking refugees to be admitted into the country without proper vetting and processing. We do have a immigration system that vets any person who comes into the border, across our borders. Let's use that system.
What would you say to those who would argue no system is perfect? There are so many refugees that what about the chance that another extremist with an AK-47 potentially could be handed to him, could get through and cause more carnage, could cause more tragedy?
I mean, that person can cause carnage coming in as an illegal across the border, some of the news reports suggest that one or more of the attackers in the Paris case may have crossed over into France illegally. They could come across the borders through other legal means. So targeting the refugees as the problem, the refugees did not create ISIS. Refugees are fleeing ISIS. So we have to show empathy for the people that are feeling the pain of ISIS, much like we are feeling the pain of ISIS.
Sherry in Arlington. Hi, Sherry. What are your thoughts?
Yes, this is sort of an emotional response too, and I would like to be a good liberal, but this has been a question on my mind for a while, and I want to sort of take advantage of the esteemed speakers. This is probably sort of fueled by rhetoric. There was a law in Florida, something about saying, you know, afraid of Sharia law. And I read a New York Times article recently that some people are putting arbitration agreements in where people have to go before a religious court. And I would just like for you to speak about separation of church and state and how people are afraid of these Sharia law kinds of things coming to this country to suppress women. And like I said, I'd like to be a good liberal. I know this is not a good liberal question, but I do have it. So thank you.
Sherry, thanks. And that actually ties in somewhat to the talk you'll be giving tonight. Chris Roederer.
Well, There are a number of mechanisms for individuals to resolve disputes through contract relationships, and in those contracts, they often put in clauses for arbitration, and sometimes they require that they arbitrate their grievances through religious mechanisms. Christians do it. Muslims do it. The thinking behind a lot of those is that as a member of that community, that's a more friendly way of resolving those disputes within that community. The problem comes with any of a number of these kind of arbitration agreements when you fall out of that community and maybe you're still bound by those agreements that you made or that your parents made for you. And then, of course, you have this, you know, as some what you might think of as an illiberal situation, and that those institutions then are protected and insulated from scrutiny. And that's unfortunate. And it's part of the problem with arbitration agreements in general.
But what about her original question, the fear so many Americans have when it comes to Sharia law and the perception that many Westerners have as pertains to the lack of free speech, the oppression of women, and on, Dr. Ahmed?
First of all, Sharia is to Muslims what canon law is to Catholics and halakha law is to Jews. It is a code of a religious edicts, principles, laws that govern the religious life of a Muslim, just like canon law would govern the religious life of a Catholic or halakha law will govern the religious life of a Jew. Much of Sharia is actually about prayer and fasting and giving charity and being good to our neighbors. Now, there are some parts of Sharia that deal with either rights of women or deal with polygamy or other aspects of it that actually in many cases do not apply to Muslims living in the United States. For example, polygamy is part of Sharia, but no American Muslim practices polygamy because it is not allowed by the law. So anytime there is a conflict between Sharia and what is understood to be the U.S. law, the U.S. Constitution, obviously the U.S. law and the U.S. Constitution will trump that as long as we are protective of religious freedom. So this has been an age-old conflict in this country, trying to uphold the secular laws and the secular values and yet at the same time protecting religious laws and religious values.
Dr. Chris Roederer will give a talk tonight. Go see him. Discuss When the Government Should Shut Up, Religion, Abortion, and Confederate Flags, an irresistible title. He'll speak at the Buckman Bridge Unitarian Universalist Church. That's at 8447 Manresa Road in Jacksonville. Dr. Parvez Ahmed, professor with UNF, both of you joining us this morning in studio, and we thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Later, Culpepper on the Jaguars' thrilling last-minute victory over the Ravens. We'll also hear from Firehouse Subs founders Chris and Robin Sorensen on the big donation to Hometown Heroes they'll make Thursday night during the Jags halftime show. But up next, progress in the fight against type 1 diabetes. Back in a moment.
Sweeping changes could be in store for Duval Public Schools, including school zone boundary shifts, school uniforms, and underperforming schools being converted into special academies. WJCT's Community Thread invites you to tune in for a conversation hosted by Melissa Ross with Duval County Superintendent Nikolai Vitti and community stakeholders about the direction of our schools. Community Thread, Thursday night at 8 on WJCT Public Television.
Sometimes it seems like the news industry is one big runaway train headed way too fast, destination unknown. I'm Audie Cornish. At All Things Considered, we plan our daily voyage carefully and take the time to see the important sights along the way. Don't worry, we'll still get you where you need to go. All Things Considered from NPR News. Enjoy the journey.
Weekday afternoons from 4 to 6 on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
Welcome back. Well, they are the leading global organization funding research into type 1 diabetes. That's the type diagnosed in children and young adults. JDRF, the Juvenile Diabetes Research Foundation, says that by the year 2050, 5 million people are expected to be living with type 1 diabetes. That includes a threefold growth in young people with the disease. Now, November is National Diabetes Awareness Month, and there's lots happening around town to engage the community. Brooks Biagini is executive director of the JDRF North Florida chapter. Also with us, board member and communications chair Stacy Ellison. Ladies, good morning.
Good morning.
And so a huge spike expected, Brooks, in kids and young people with diabetes, type 1 diabetes. So much awareness and effort on this is needed.
Absolutely. So type 1 diabetes, as you probably know, is an autoimmune disease. It's completely different from type 2 diabetes. We don't know exactly what is causing the increase, but we, you know, scientists are looking at genetics, is also environmental triggers. When somebody's diagnosed with type 1 diabetes, their pancreas stops producing insulin, and so they must take shots and test their blood sugar and count carbohydrates throughout the day to live. So that's the difference in type 1 and type 2 diabetes. Type 2 diabetes, a person is able to produce insulin, but something's holding their system up from doing exactly what it needs to do. A lot of times it can be weight, it can be genetics, it can be a variety of reasons. But unlike type 1 diabetes that is not curable at this time, type 2 diabetes can often be managed and sometimes cured from diet and exercise.
And Stacy, during National Diabetes Awareness Month, JDRF is launching a national campaign, Type 1 Diabetes Looks Like Me. Tell us about it.
Well, it's a wonderful opportunity for those who are not familiar with type 1 to see the wide range of individuals affected by this disease. As Brooks was speaking earlier, there are so many misconceptions concerning type 1. It is not lifestyle related. It is not something that with change of lifestyle can be cured. And this campaign seeks to share that information with people, that it can be a young child, it can be an older person, it can be a college student. And by relating the information in that way, people can then say, how does this affect your life? What are the details that go into your everyday struggle to remain healthy? And we can spread awareness in that way.
Doug in Jacksonville is on the line with a question about Diabetes Awareness Month. Hi, Doug. Good morning. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you. I'm not actually asking a question. I just wanted to convey that this is my 36th year with type 1 diabetes. At 24, I went into a coma for 2 days, and I just turned 60. So,
wow.
This is a huge disease for me, and what the best thing I always say to people that I meet is it's a daily battle. You have to work hard and check and just everything that you put in your mouth raises your sugar and causes you problems. So people at work, wherever I go, I've talked to groups of people, and it's just so important. It's type 1 to watch what you eat, pretty much.
Sure. Well, Doug, congrats on managing it so well. I know that's been a challenge, and Doug's story is like so many others, Brooks.
Absolutely. And Doug, kudos to you for being an advocate on bringing awareness to type 1 diabetes. And we know that so many, my aunt, dear aunt to me, has had type 1 diabetes for over 40 years as well. And, you know, JDRF has been around for 45 years now, and so many improvements have been made in the way of life improvements for making diabetes easier to manage. It's still a daily battle, like Doug mentioned, but there are improvements such as the artificial pancreas that JDRF is working on, something, you know, the insulin pump, of course, is huge, continuous glucose monitors. So people like Doug, what we're doing now with some of the research that JDRF funds is helping to reduce those long-term complications so that a person with type 1 diabetes, whether they're diagnosed as a child or an adult, can be more likely to have the opportunity to live a long and healthy life.
And you need to register now to participate in the JDRF One Walk. That's scheduled for April 16th, 2016 at Metropolitan Park here in downtown Jacksonville. Just go to jdrf.org/Jacksonville and register now for that walk coming up next spring. Thanks so much for joining us, Brooks Biagini, Executive Director of the JDRF North Florida Chapter, and Board Member and Communications Chair Stacy Ellison, both with us this morning. Thank you.
Thank you.
And coming up, Sports with Cole, plus Firehouse Subs founders Chris and Robin Sorensen on their special donation coming up during this week's Jaguars game.
WJCT and the Florida Theater are proud to present Michael Feldman's What Do You Know Live. That's right, I'm bringing my show to Jacksonville on February 20th. We'll do the quiz, have some fun, enjoy a little bit of a break from the Wisconsin winter. So, do your holiday shopping earlier, surprise your Valentine next February. Tickets available now at the Florida Theater box office by phone at 904-355-2787 or online at floridatheater.com.
This is the sound of drama. This is the sound of your community.
Good morning, and live from Studio 5, this is First Coast Connect on 89.
Stay connected. Stay informed. Enjoy live streaming of your favorite local WJCT and PBS and NPR content, all free from your devices. The WJCT app, available now in the Apple App Store and Google Play.
Well, this Thursday night, Firehouse Subs Public Safety Foundation and the Jacksonville Jaguars are teaming up to award hometown heroes from multiple public safety organizations some $182,000 worth of life-saving equipment. It'll happen during the halftime show against the Tennessee Titans. Since the foundation's inception, $15 million has been donated to first responders, specifically $2.5 million here in Florida alone. The foundation's founders are firefighting brothers Chris and Robin Sorensen of Firehouse Subs fame. Chris Sorensen joins us now in studio to give us a preview of all the excitement Thursday night. Chris, a pleasure. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Melissa.
And the foundation, of course, is really just an incredible organization, one that you and your brother decided to form, I take it, after Hurricane Katrina. Is that right?
Yeah, we... Our initial plan was to go over and feed the Jacksonville first responders. We knew they needed help over there with all that going on. And so we took our tour bus and a tractor trailer full of food. And, of course, I should have known, but, you know, the fire department was well taken care of on the food end.
Right.
And
they know how to cook.
Yes, we do.
You guys are living proof of that.
And so it ended up being suggested by one of the police officers there that so many people had not yet even been attended to or seen. So we decided to take that food into the actual area where it happened. And we ended up in Waveland. And right at ground zero, and, you know, it was just devastating. And we fed people there in several areas, but it was just a great experience, and it's really what kicked off the real direction of where we wanted to take our foundation.
And so you decided to go a step further. Since that time, you have really made an impact with helping first responders. And now, this Thursday evening, something really special is going to happen.
Yes, we're going to make a $215,000 check presentation pregame this Thursday at the Titans and Jags. And with 15 different agencies that will receive the grant. And we've donated in Florida close to $3 million and about $1.2 million here in the First Coast area.
And what is so exciting about this foundation, the mission, I love the tagline, serving subs and saving lives.
Mm-hmm.
Anytime anybody goes into a Firehouse Subs and has a tasty sub, they can help with the mission of the foundation. You can drop spare change into the donation canister at the register. You can round up your credit card at the register to the nearest dollar. That money goes to the foundation. I didn't know that, but
yes.
I've learned that. You can buy a recycled 5-gallon pickle bucket at a Firehouse Subs for just $2 and use it for painting, gardening, washing the car, whatever you like. All proceeds benefit the foundation.
Correct.
Such easy ways. That did you and Robin come up with all those ideas?
Well, not to take credit for the pickle bucket. It was actually one of our franchisee area reps you know, we'd been throwing them away. And it's a great idea. It was such a great idea. And we sell them for a bargain, really, compared to what they, at the time, were being sold at the places. And, you know, it keeps them out of landfills. And you would not believe all the YouTube videos and things we've received, what people do with them. It's just amazing. Even Halloween, they had a kid wearing one. I don't know how they got him in it. But anyway, it's it all adds up when you round up and the spare change, pickle buckets. We have a lot of challenges, my brother Robin and I do, with our franchise community, where we, you know, we'll match monies donated by them and special events for our customers that will match the funds that they donate.
That is just terrific. And so again, he is Chris Sorensen, of course, of Firehouse Subs fame. He and his brother Robin, the co-founders, the Firehouse Subs Public Safety Foundation, doing the check presentation Thursday night at the Jaguars-Titans game. Chris, I do need to cut this short because right now we are going to NPR's special live coverage of President Obama's news conference from the G20 summit in Turkey. This special anchored by Steve Inskeep with analysis from NPR's Eleanor Beardsley and Peter Kenyon in Paris